Good afternoon and welcome to the afternoon session on Saturday for the 2008 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium. This is session 356, I Love You No Matter What. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone to please silence any cell phones or pagers. Once we hear from the panelists, the paper, and the respondent, we will probably have some time for some questions or comments. Please limit those comments to just a couple minutes to allow for everybody to be able to talk. And also, any questions, please direct them through the microphone so that we can capture them on the recording. Today we have Emily Peterson. She's a graduate student at Weber State University studying English. She earned her BA in English with a minor in humanities from Brigham Young University in 2001. Her interests include American literature and folklore, and she presented a paper on the comic dynamics of the beauty pageant at the Folklore Society of Utah's conference in 2001. She's worked as a professional editor for the LDS Church, as a proofreader for Brigham Young University's independent study program, and as a volunteer proofreader for the Enzyme magazine. She's currently a stay-at-home mom and a piano teacher, and she plans to pursue a PhD after completing her master's degree. Following Emily, Paul Tinker will be our respondent. He is a retired attorney and a longtime Sunstone participant and attendee. He graduated from BYU and has his JD from the University of Utah. Emily?
My dad's not gay. You're a liar. I had never spoken to anybody with such vehemence, but I did so now to Jenny, a childhood friend. I had always been a mild-mannered and kind girl, but I could not accept that what she had told me was true. We were settled in her bedroom, a square room with the smell of newly painted walls and the consuming emptiness of a vacant plant shelf in the vault. It was well past bedtime, and my two younger sisters were sprawled on the carpet, snoring in their sleeping bags. Minutes earlier, Jenny and I had been telling stories about boys and music. Now I was learning the most devastating news of my life at the age of 9. I had needed a drink moments before, so Jenny and I crept to the kitchen. We had passed the still-lit Christmas tree, then flooded the kitchen with light and raided the refrigerator. When we tiptoed back to bed, I noticed something I hadn't before. As we passed the master bedroom, I realized that both my dad and Dale, Jenny's father, were sleeping in the same bed. The door was wide open, and the two of them snored on their backs, unaware that Jenny and I were still up, having a homemade sleepover. We reached her bedroom and shut the door softly, giggling that we hadn't been caught. As we settled back on her bed, overfull with pillows to talk, I said, "Our dads are having a sleepover, too. They're sleeping in the same bed." Jenny's smile vanished, and she looked at me seriously. "Emily, it isn't a sleepover." "What do you mean? Do you really want to know?" Her brown eyes were wide, full of concern. I wasn't sure if I wanted to know what she was about to tell me, but I said yes anyway. "They're gay, Emily. That's why they're in the same bed." And that's what led to my angry denial. I have a few memories of my father before he left, but the most vivid is of his absence. It began on a Sunday morning, with my dad in bed sick, while my mom, my two sisters, and I got dressed for church. My dad was a San Jose City police officer who often worked graveyards, making the situation unremarkable. He could have been sick, he could have been tired. I remember coming home from church to an empty house, my mother going from room to room, looking for my father, making it a game with us children. She called his name and looked in closets. At the time, it seemed my dad was teasing us, until my mom opened the closet in the master bedroom and we found his side of it empty. There were no ties hanging from the rack on the inside of the door. There were no clothes. There were no shoes. This is all I remember. I was only 5. I now know that despite the absence of all his material possessions, there was a letter on the bed for my mom. I know that she read it. All of her vital organs seemed to drop from her body, and she cried. She also probably called my grandma. I don't remember this, but I know that it happened. My mom would later tell me about the letter when I was a teenager. I don't know what it said, but it couldn't have been pleasant for my mother to hear. She had three young children to care for, and suddenly found out that there would be no husband to care for her. When I reached adulthood, my mom explained her surprise at my father leaving. She had always described their marriage as a perfect one. They both loved quilting and decorating. My dad often helped with household chores. They never fought. These were the myths I believed of my parents' short 6-year marriage. After I married, I realized that this could not exactly be true, especially when I realized how unhappy my father had been. My sisters fought with my mom through their teenage years, and my father always sympathized, saying our mother had been stubborn and hard to deal with her entire life. After hearing my dad's opinion of my mom's infamous personality, I wanted to hear my mom's side of their early marriage. She continued to uphold her long-told story of the perfect marriage. I was tired of hearing that and finally asked her if she knew he was gay before he left. In one of her more honest moments, she explained that she had no idea. She felt something was strange that morning when we went to church, but she didn't know what it was until we got home and found him gone. "What about the letter?" I asked. "Did he explain it in the letter?" "No, he just said he was leaving. I was flabbergasted and heartbroken. I didn't know what to think, so I prayed," Mom explained. "You prayed?" "Yes, and the Lord told me that he was gay. It was revealed to me." "Wow, what did you do?" "I called your father, and I told him I knew what his problem was, that he was gay. I told him we should try to work it out, that I'd help him. However, that never happened. My dad did not come back and try to pretend to be the husband that he wasn't. At one time in my teenage years, I remember my mom mentioning, after she remarried, that my dad had expressed his regret of not staying. However, I don't think he regrets this now. He continues to live his preferred lifestyle. After I yelled at her for being what I thought was a liar, Jenny's face deepened with concern. She must have realized what she'd driven me, quiet and shy Emily, to do. "Yes, they are gay," she explained evenly. "My mom told me." Jenny then told the story her mom had told, how our dads had met and fallen in love, and both decided to leave their wives and children for each other. The news filled me with a sickness that didn't go away for years. I knew that what Jenny revealed was true. My heart knew it so violently that it tried to beat its way out of my chest, but I didn't want to accept it. "No, no, no," I told her. "You're lying or mistaken. My dad's not gay." I said this so angrily that Jenny relented. The tears pouring down my cheeks probably warned her against saying anything more as well. "When you get home, you can ask your mom about it. Let's go to sleep now," she suggested, dropping the subject. We turned out her bedroom light, and I got into my sleeping bag. We said our goodnights, and soon afterwards, Jenny's breathing became even and rhythmic. I laid there with my eyes open, my heart still smarting at the news. Everything Jenny had said to me made sense. I knew what it meant to be a homosexual, that you loved the same sex. I knew that it was strange and different, and I knew that he would never come back to my mother now, never come back to me. I thought there was still hope. I thought we would someday return to California to live with him again. He hadn't remarried the way my mom had. I imagined that he still pined for her, for his family. All of those illusions were shattered that night. My stomach felt cold and empty. I didn't want what Jenny had said to be true, but I knew that it was. I also realized that his gayness posed an enormous problem for me. My earliest memories of my dad's work included him taking us to meet his coworkers or secretaries. My dad would say, "These are my daughters, Emily, Haley, and Afton." The co-worker would inevitably say, "Oh, they're darling, Ron. Look at this one. She looks just like you. She's a carbon copy of you," while pointing at me. I'd feel so proud to earn that distinction, the daughter who looked like Dad. As I lay in Jenny's room, the darkness surrounding my misery, I realized that I was a carbon copy of my father. I decided that must mean that I was exactly like him. So far in my life, I'd noticed that I had inherited his picky personality and perfectionist persona. I liked to organize and keep things clean, something I'd obviously gotten from my dad. He had always been fastidious in everything, his dress, manners, and housekeeping. I felt dread creep into my heart. Did my similarity to him mean that I would be gay too? I tried to decide, but felt sick. I couldn't be gay. My only knowledge of the homosexual lifestyle was that it was a sin, and you would go to hell for it. I did not want that for myself or for my father. I began to sob, for I felt that my father would be eternally damned, and me right along with him. I returned home to Utah after the Christmas vacation, dejected and guilt-ridden. I had already become a worrier in my young life, worrying over my parents' divorce, my mother's emotional welfare, my schoolwork, my sisters, my new baby brother, the many times I'd moved, and life in general. Now I added to that list my father's eternal welfare, along with my own sense of self. I had no idea who I was or what I would become. I had always strived toward perfection, and now that was shattered. It had been ruined years earlier, my ideal family torn apart, but now I knew why, and the reason was ugly and secret. It was something so horrible that I couldn't tell anybody, not even my mother. How could I talk to her about something so awful, so personal for us both? So I decided to leave a normal life. I resumed playing with my sisters, eating dinner with the family, loading the dishwasher, watching my favorite television show, practicing piano, returning to school, doing homework, and just being. However, each night I'd crawl into bed, turn out the light, and cry myself to sleep. The pain seemed to rip through my body. The worry tore me apart. I remember the physical sensation of hurt, although nothing was physically injured. I can still feel that pain, the remembrance of it, and I still feel it on occasion now when I reflect on certain difficulties from my past, certain things I cannot get over, no matter how old and mature I become. I don't think children can ever truly get over the pain of their parents' divorce or other childhood traumas, such as abuse. The pain is always there, but we can learn to manage it. I have learned to manage, just like everybody else. My ability to manage the pain began one evening during my nightly crying ritual. My sobbing became uncontrollable, so loud, in fact, that my mother came in to check on me. I remember feeling embarrassed that I'd been caught, that my secret worry would now have to be revealed. But I also felt a great sense of relief. I wanted to tell my mother what I had learned, to ask her if it was true, but I did not dare. Maybe my crying became loud on purpose. Maybe it was a cry for help. My mother stood in the doorway, the light from the hall surrounding her. She wore a blue terry cloth robe and asked with compassion what was wrong. Instead of breaking the news gently, as I had been plotting to the last several days, I blurted out, "Is Dad really gay?" Then sobbed with renewed vengeance, unable to breathe any longer. My mom immediately came to my bed and showed affection. When I calmed slightly, she invited me into her room for a talk. I climbed beside her as I had many times before, then snuggled under the quilt. My mom began by asking me what had precipitated my hysterics. I explained to her how Jenny had told me about Dad and Dale. Mom then answered honestly, saying that it was true and that Jenny had been correct. This prompted a new wave of tears, which my mom patiently allowed before continuing our conversation. She asked if there was anything I wanted to know about the situation. I tearfully told her my fear, choking out each word with strain. I did not want to be gay like my father, because it was against God, but I felt that I was doomed to be because of my likeness to my father. "We all have agency, Emily," Mom responded. "Yes, you look like your dad, but that doesn't mean you are the same person. You can choose who you want to be." I guess you're right, I said through a sob. I wiped my nose and rubbed my eyes. The salt left my skin red and raw. It is just so horrible. I can't believe he's gay. It was then that my mother did the best thing she's ever done for me. She spent the next hour telling me all the good things she could remember about my dad. This began a healthy healing process that would continue for the next 20 years. Your father is a wonderful man. He spends money to fly you to see him every chance he gets. Not all fathers do that, you know, my mom explained. I nodded, trying to get into the spirit of her uplifting words. He is excellent at quilting and knows how to sew. How many other dads can do that? She nudged me playfully. I giggled a little. She was right. None of my friends could say that their dads had made them a dress. Dad is good at French braiding, I added. You can't even do that. My mom laughed. It's true, he's always been better at fixing your and your sister's hair than I have. He's also a dedicated police officer. Remember the time he ripped out his pants while chasing a suspect? I laughed. I love his police stories. But he's also a good singer and dancer. I like dancing with him. He's an excellent dancer. What about the way he supports your piano lessons? He pays for them, my mom said. That's true, I said. He always enjoys it when we play the piano for him. Did you know he can play some of the hymns by ear? I guess that's where Haley gets her perfect pitch. I'm sure she gets it from him, because it certainly didn't come from me, my mom joked. He's also very talented at languages. He speaks Spanish and French. I had begun to feel better. My tears were drying, and the dark, heavy feeling of guilt began to lift. After a few more minutes of mommy time, I was ready to return to bed. I slept soundly that night. I knew that I wasn't going to be gay, and that it was okay to love my father, even though he was. That experience with my mom was the beginning of my understanding of what true love is. My religion told me that my dad's lifestyle was wrong, yet he remained my father. He was still a good person, still kind, still loving, and still wonderful. Through the years, I've reconciled these things. I've built a knowledge of who I am and who he is and how that fits together. One such moment came while watching Oprah. I sometimes think this experience is too silly to share, but it honestly changed me completely. The actress Sharon Stone, who some consider to be raunchy, told Oprah about her near-death experience after having a stroke. She explained that when she went to the next life, she felt love and light. At that moment, it hit me. God loves everybody. I laughed out loud and cried a little when I realized that even Sharon Stone, a woman who had not lived the way my religion teaches, felt the love of God when she died for a few minutes. His love is available to all, including my father. From this, I learned not to judge and just to love. And that is why I finally talked to my dad about his orientation about a year ago. My husband and I had flown to California for my cousin's wedding. There we spent the time with my dad eating out, visiting the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and shopping. Things finally settled down just before the wedding. We were sitting in the audience, and my husband and daughter on one side of me, and my dad was on the other. All of the guests were dressed fabulously, and the scent of roses filled the air. The wedding had not yet started, so I turned to my dad in one of my braver moments and began to talk. I don't know exactly how I started the conversation, but eventually I had the courage to ask, "When did you know that you were gay?" My dad cocked his head and nervously bounced his knees. "Well, right after my mission, I was at BYU and all of my friends were dating girls, and I realized that I didn't really want to date any girls." "So what did you do?" I asked eagerly, fascinated to finally get the story from him. I'd had no idea he knew before he was married. "I went to my bishop. He told me to date anyway and get married. He said once I found the right girl and married her, everything would be okay." "So sex would cure you, huh?" I laughed. He chuckled. "Yes, that's what they told us in those days." He paused and stared ahead at nothing. He seemed far away, almost as if he were reliving the stress of his decision years ago. It doesn't work. Obviously, I said, but I think the church is getting better at dealing with this. I was hoping to comfort him. Yes, they are, my dad agreed. I could see a longing in his blue as Paul Newman eyes. He seemed to be thinking that he wished the church he'd joined at 14 and found such love and acceptance from would accept him once again. We continued to hold our quiet yet momentous conversation until the wedding procession began. We spent the rest of the evening laughing and talking. When the dance floor finally opened up, my dad took me in his arms and we floated around the room, waltzing and foxtrotting. We smiled with each other more because of our comfort. My dad now understood that my religion did not make me hate him. I understood that my dad still loved me despite my belief in a religion that shuns him. We had finally said, "I love you no matter what." In the time that has followed, we have continued to have an open conversation on the subject. I don't feel embarrassed asking him about his partner or openly mentioning the fact that he's gay. He is more open with me and feels more accepted because he knows that I won't judge him. We are comfortable enough to be ourselves, even if we live by different standards and moral codes. We are bonded because we are father and daughter, and nothing, even homosexuality, can come between us. A few months ago, I visited Paris and London with my husband, my dad, his partner, and my grandmother. On this trip, I did not watch to see if my dad touched his partner. I did not wonder if they kissed when the lights went out. I did not define him by his homosexuality. I instead marveled at his command of the French language, discovered that he also speaks Italian and Portuguese, thanked him when he took us out for many expensive dinners, talked with him about the Louvre's artwork, laughed with him about the antics of other tourists, and hugged him tightly when it was time to say goodbye. Thank you.
I hope and sense that many of you also felt the power of that rather brief autobiography and the testimony of Christian love that is embodied in it. I want to explain just briefly, I do not bring the professional credentials to this task that the designated responder would have, who is a family therapist, and she was at the last minute unable to be here at Sunstone. So I am speaking just as a very interested observer. Secondly, in terms of our format here at Sunstone, where we give papers and then we have respondents, this is a personal essay, not a scholarly treatise or something that can be analyzed. It's truly personal, and a person's experience is their experience. You cannot take away from or add to their experience. So commentary is limited, but I do, in spite of that, just want to make a few points and perhaps pose a couple of questions that could motivate us into some further discussion. One point that I would make, and I see people in the room who can attest to this is a relatively happy story compared to many that could be told in this genre within our community of where a father comes out as gay and leaves the family. I know of circumstances myself where the outcome, at least so far, has not been nearly so fortuitous. And so Emily is blessed in that regard, and I think that she recognizes that, and I'm grateful that she has conveyed that to us. Maybe this shows my age and my lack of awareness of the younger generation. I'm really quite astounded at the degree of sophistication and awareness that Emily was able to bring to this issue, even at the age of 9. I would like to know a little more of the detail about that. In terms of the essay itself, there were because of the way it's constructed, and which I think there is very purposeful and artful, I had to be careful that I was keeping track of the time period, that the episode with Jenny took place at the age of 9 years, where Dad had actually left when Emily was 5. It's important to keep that chronology straight, and I wasn't entirely clear how much later, after the conversation with Jenny, it was that Emily had the conversation with her mother. I gather it was not a very long period of time. I had one little nitpicking thing that Emily would appreciate as an editor, and lo and behold, in one place, she had already changed it from the draft that I read to the draft that she gave this afternoon. So I know that she's very sensitive to these things. Twice in the copy that I had, she had used the word lifestyle. I find the word lifestyle a bit problematic, although I know it's a common term used for this. But, you know, I've asked people, well, tell me about your gay lifestyle. And they say, well, my lifestyle is I have to get up and I have to go to work, and the mortgage has to be paid, or the rent, and the bills come in and they have to be paid, and once in a while we go out and socialize, and what do you mean by gay lifestyle? And then I've asked, well, okay, if there is a gay lifestyle, is there a straight lifestyle? What's that about? Anyway, the word is problematic, but I understand that we use it, and I was impressed that on the second usage in her essay today, Emily had changed it to orientation. And maybe she'll find a way to change the other usage. What I'd really like to know more about is all that happened in the interim between the time that she had this very frank and forthright conversation with her mother. All that happened in the meantime between that and the time that she was able to converse directly with her father about it. Based on other experiences that I'm aware of, my sense is that probably a lot happened during that time period, and if you would like to elaborate on it, any of that would be wonderful. One thing in particular in that regard that I'm curious about is really how long it took you to really internalize the idea that just because your father was gay, that you were not necessarily subject to being gay, and that your mother was correct on that. In many cases, it takes a long, long time to really internalize the correct answer to those kinds of fears. So those are the general observations that I would make. As I say, it's a personal essay and not subject to the kind of more formal criticism that we ordinarily give at for Sunstone Papers. And besides that, we really want Emily to come back and present more at Sunstone.
I think this story is relatively happy because my parents made it that way. I think my mom and dad were both very mature and decided to be kind to one another even though there was a difficult circumstance, for the welfare and sake of their children. They did have the three of us, and I think they maintained that for quite a while. Things kind of deteriorated once my sisters got older and other family matters came up, and my parents no longer speak to one another. But I think that's one reason why it's been relatively happy, and I also think that my attitude and the way that I've decided to respond to it is a reason why the outcome is happy. I could have chosen to ignore my dad or disown him, or, you know, there are numerous accounts of that happening to people, and I just don't think that's the right way to live, especially in this LDS culture. If we say that we're Christians, then we should act like Christ. And that's why I think the outcome has been happy. As to my awareness at 9 years old, I think that's just something that, because it was becoming more prominent and more people were talking about it, I think it's something that all 9-year-olds are aware of what homosexuality is. I don't, and yet it may just be a generation gap.
That's what I was afraid of.
Sorry to confirm that for you. the use of the term lifestyle, I honestly did not know that was a little bit offensive or cliche or the wrong usage until I sent this essay to my sister who lives in New Hampshire, and she mentioned to me that orientation is a better word to use, and me being the little Mormon girl, I didn't know that. So she kind of helped me clear that one up. I should have changed it in both places. In the gap between being 9 and being 28, a lot has happened. I've spent many vacations at my dad's house wondering why he had a book on his bookshelf called Gay Mormons. But not daring to ask him. I never talked to him about it because he lived in California and we lived in Utah, and I never had the opportunity to really get to know my dad as much as I would have liked as a child, because, as I said, I was very shy, and I felt like I almost didn't know him growing up. And once, you know, I became an adult and got out of my skin a little bit and became a little more assertive and confident with who I was, I felt more willing to talk with him about things and to get to know, you know, his feelings on the subject, and to ask if, you know, do you still love us even though you left? And just those poignant questions. I think it took me a few years to figure out that I wouldn't be gay like my dad. I was 9, and I think there's just some maturing that goes on where you figure out who you are, and I think that's the same for everybody. But after my mom reassured me, that was definitely a big relief to realize that I could still love my dad, and that just looking like him didn't make me the exact same person as him. So, anyway. Open up the questions.
Questions or comments?
Hello, I'm Olin Thomas. I just wanted to thank you for your study. It was very beautiful, well-written, well-read. So I hope that you take the opportunity to, you know, present this at other places as well. It's a story that a lot of people need to hear. I just wanted to, one that you're talking about, you know, the early age that you had to deal with that, and just a little story from my history that sort of illustrates it, that kids do think about that. My mother brought her grandchildren, my nephew and niece, over to my house for me to take them to a theme park one day, and I was living at the time in a one-bedroom condo with my partner, and we had a single bed and a single bedroom, and my nephew was like 10, and my niece about 12, 11 and a half, 12. And I had never talked to them about me being gay because this didn't seem appropriate at their age. And they were doing something in the house while I was getting something out of the car. And they noticed the one bed. And they started talking amongst themselves in front of my mother about there being one bed and there's two men that lived in the house. And my nephew, who was the younger one, said, "Well, maybe Sydney sleeps on the sofa." And my niece turned to him and said, "He doesn't sleep on the sofa." And it made me realize for the first time, you know, that my example would be noticed by the children in my family. In my case, just nephews and nieces, but it is very important. And I realized that what made it a non-issue for them was that the adults in their lives, their parents, my brothers and sisters, and my grandparents, you know, their grandparents, my parents, did not act like it was unusual. And I think I really appreciate your mother did that. I'm sure that was had a big influence on you. So I just want to thank you for that.
When you talked about the acceptance that came a year ago, were you talking about the trip to France, or how did that... I missed it somehow.
I think accepting it definitely started with that conversation with my mother, which is why I included it in the essay. And then I had some pretty poignant experiences in college that helped me to realize that it's not okay to judge people. And it wasn't always just about my dad. I learned this lesson with a sister of mine and also with just people that I came in contact with. And I think that started it. And then a year ago was when I talked to him about it. And that's when I finally felt like I was comfortable with it, because I'd already accepted him, but I wanted him to know that I accepted him. So that's really what I was talking about there.
But he's very grateful for that.
I think so. I mean, he hasn't outright said that, but he definitely acts a little more comfortable. And when we talk on the phone, he's, you know, he mentions his partner and what they've been up to without, I think, feeling like I'm going to be uncomfortable with it or judge him for it.
Don't sit down too quickly. So it sounds like in the timeline, the chronology, your mother knew for about 4 years before you found out. The conversation that you had with your mother, where she helped you initially, how long had passed between the time you had found out and that conversation? And do you know anything about how your mother might have processed everything in that time? Did you have any conversations about how she has dealt with that?
I think it was probably only about a week between the time I found out and I told my mom. I can't remember for sure because it was a long time ago. But being 9, I think it was as soon as I got home, I just started crying every night and she heard me. So I think it was a week or two between when I found out and we had the conversation. And what was the other question?
Do you know anything about her process?
Okay. Yeah, I talked to her about this when I was writing the essay and asked her if she remembered that conversation that we had. And she said, oh yeah, that happened like right after your dad left when you were 5 and we still lived in California. And she had a completely different view of that conversation, and I specifically remember I was older and that we'd lived, you know, in Utah and totally different circumstances. I suspect that maybe we had the conversation more than once, because she said the conversation we had when I was 5 was that I came home crying and that some of my friends had told me that my dad was a bad man because he left, and I think maybe some rumors were going around the ward or the neighborhood, and so that was when, and I said, I don't ever want to see my dad again. I don't want to be like him. He's a bad man. And she explained to me that, no, he wasn't, that he was still a good person. And so I think she probably had to tell me that a few times before I got it. So.
Could you tell us something about how your sisters adjusted to this news?
Well, one of my sisters is actually here, so maybe we could have her come answer that question. I know they are both very okay with it. Actually, both of them no longer affiliate themselves with the LDS Church. They both decided to just, you know, live without it because they love their dad, and I think that it's an important thing for them to support their dad, and those two things don't match up in their mind. I've been able to match them up in my mind, but everyone's different. So, Afton, if you want to come say how you reacted. She hasn't thought about this, but...
Oh, gosh. Well, I would mainly have to say that the main reason that I left the LDS Church was difficulty reconciling the fact that I knew that my father was gay from childhood, and the doctrines and teachings and the feelings that I had about what that meant about, you know, eternal salvation. And, you know, since my childhood, I've grown and changed quite a bit, as I believe most people do. And I actually just graduated from college and gained my bachelor's degree in gender studies. I've actually studied sexuality, gender roles, and sexual orientation quite a bit, and have, I think, learned to reconcile that you can be a good person and be different, and that religion may not necessarily be the only path, you know, toward gaining a broader spiritual perspective of who you are and your place in the universe. And it certainly it doesn't speak to what type of person you are or what your value is in the world. And aside from that, I love my father, and he's a very good person. So I think that's all I really have to speak to on that.
I may have missed something, but didn't you earlier say something about your father didn't always have kind things to say about your mother, and after he left, where she was always very, never said anything bad about him. Would you elaborate what the thing was going on there?
My mom is crazy. No, my mom has always been kind of a fiery personality. She's one of the most famous stories my grandma has told about her is that she threw a shoe at one of her boyfriends for being late for picking him up for a date during high school. So that's just my mom's personality. She's very difficult to get along with. And he commented on that when my sisters were older and they were kind of fighting with my mom through those rough teenage years. And that's when my dad said that. He never said anything when we were younger or caused any sort of fights or custody battles or no, but just to sympathize with my sisters who were kind of struggling with my mom's personality at that time. So, and that's why I didn't invite my mom.
You know she can download this after, right? I'm really interested also in maybe hearing about navigating the teenage years. You've seemed to reconcile a lot of things in a very mature way, but I'm sure there was quite a bit of wrestling going on, especially through young women's or through the teachings that we hear on Sunday. We speak very often in very general terms and don't really understand what kind of pain we're causing an individual. Would you speak to that and how you maybe wrestle with some of those issues?
I think as a teenager I had a really hard time with it, especially because my mom told me not to tell anyone when that conversation occurred. And that is because we lived in a very small, mostly Mormon town. And I think it was wise of her to say, don't tell anyone, because I would have been ridiculed at school. I would have probably been very upset by anyone teasing me. And so it was probably the smart thing to do. But the hard part for me was then keeping it a secret when I would hear people say mean things or, you know, it was that internal struggle of knowing that I was different and that someone was making fun of someone in my family. You know, as to doctrines of the church, I don't remember those really bothering me. I do know that sometimes in the LDS religion and culture, we get bishops who aren't perfect because no one's perfect. And I know my sister had an experience where a bishop told her, you need to stop thinking about and loving your father and just accept your stepfather because your father's going to hell. You know, and I don't agree with comments like that. I think they're more hurtful than helpful. And I think those are the kinds of things that were hard to struggle with, was maybe the opinions of leaders who weren't familiar with the situation and hadn't maybe developed a broader perspective on it. So that's all I have to say about that.
I have one more motivation for sharing it now. Why now? Yeah.
I've always wanted to share it. I've always wanted to be a writer, and I've always heard that write what you know. This is what I know. I had the opportunity to actually put this down on paper in a class that I took as part of my master's program. It was autobiographical writing and the theory of it, and we had to write an autobiographical essay, and I thought this is the perfect opportunity for me to put this down into a neat, nice package, because I tried before and I never could really get a vision of what I wanted to do or, you know, what episodes I should share. So that's how it got written down. And the reason I want to share it is because I want people to learn to think a little bit more the way I think. I'm not saying that the way I think is perfect, but I think it's a little more open than maybe some of the people in my neighborhood or people in LDS culture in general. And I just think that it's important that people know how to respond to something like this, that it's not okay to disown a family member, and it's not okay to stop talking to someone. It's not okay to treat people badly because of this issue. We can all be friends. We can all be nice, you know, and I think that's an important issue. I especially respect the work of Carolyn Pearson. I read her most recent book, No More Goodbyes, and that really inspired me and helped me to realize that my opinion, although it is like hers, isn't shared by everybody because of some of the stories she shared in that book. And going back to maybe a little bit of the being a child in the church and hearing some of the doctrine, I know that Carolyn Pearson wrote a primary song called I'll Walk With You, and she mentions in that book, No More Goodbyes, that she wrote that not just with physical disabilities in mind, but also with homosexuality, because she knew firsthand what kind of harm could be done to a spirit that is sitting in a primary room and being told that whatever's going on in their soul or in their mind is wrong and that they are bad. So that really inspired me, and I've always loved that song, and now I think I know why.
So what is your position on the proposition in California and the church's support for that?
I don't agree with it. I understand what the church is trying to do, but as a citizen of the United States in a country where we say that we want equal rights and happiness for all, I think that means everybody. That doesn't just mean the straight people. Or, I mean, what if they came out with a proposition that said only blonde people can get married? I don't agree with it. I don't think it's right. And that's not coming from my religious perspective, but from my knowledge of the land in which we live that says that everyone deserves freedom and equality.
Would like to thank Emily for sharing this with us and Paul for responding, and have a good afternoon.